Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars about research and the formulation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very pleased today to be here at Swift Hall, the location of the History Department on the Vassar campus, with James Merrill, Professor of History on the Lucy Maynard Salmon Chair. We're going to be talking about his recent article in the William & Mary Quarterly entitled Second Thoughts on Colonial Historians and American Indians, which is about historical vocabulary and also about his two Bancroft Award-winning books, The Indians' New World, Catawbas and Their Neighbors from European Contact Through the Era of Removal, published by North Carolina Press in 1989, and Into the American Woods, Negotiators on the Pennsylvania Frontier, published by Norton in 1999. Hello, Jim.
Hello.
It's great to have you on the show today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, you know, I thought we could begin by looking at your article on vocabulary in the writing of history as a kind of window onto your two monographs, if that sounds like a plan. And the program of the article and the earlier monographs, I think, too, is to try to come to an account of our national history that acknowledges the substantial role that Native people played in our past, in conceptual terms that the Indians would recognize and understand. I mean, that's the way I read it. Not everybody reads it the same, I suppose. But, you know, in other words, I suppose the assumption is that history should acknowledge the perspective and agency of everyone involved in contributing to the events that make that history, that the point of view of those who write history should be at least that expansive. So is that a kind of fair reading of both the books and your article, the impulse behind it?
Yes, I think so, that my goal throughout my career has been to try and make the past more complex, more convoluted in terms of the number of people who are involved in that past, and especially to give agency and a place on the American stage to a wider cast of characters. In my case, it's been particularly a Native American cast of characters, but it's part of this general expansion in the course of American history since the 1960s to bring in hitherto forgotten or voiceless groups, African Americans, women, the poor, the lower class, the forgotten and obscure, that these people have been, they've gotten a lot more attention over the last generation or so than they had before. So I think I'm part of a much larger expansion of our understanding of who counts in the American past, without losing sight of the famous, but trying to get us to remember the forgotten as well.
And by doing so, I suppose you can tell a more accurate history sort of generally. I mean, not just because you're including people, but because these people play a role, and in so doing, they contribute to whatever happened in the past, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, sure.
Absolutely. And the contributions argument, I think, is not one that I've ever really joined to my own work in any kind of explicit way, because I'm not sure how you measure contributions of one kind or another, but just to recognize that, especially in the first centuries of the American experience after the Europeans arrived here in large numbers, say around 1500, that Native Americans were a dominant and at least very present part of the American social landscape. And so if you're going to look at what was happening at that time, you can't just focus on the Puritans or Virginia tobacco planters, but you have to recognize that these people were coming to someone else's homeland. And some of the most important works that have come out have in their very titles this perspective. The one that came out just as I was entering the field in the 1970s was by a man named Francis Jennings, and he wrote a book called The Invasion of America, Indians, Colonialism, and the Cant of Conquest, which just the title alone, you realize the invasion of America flips the perspective and gives us a recognition that this isn't the discovery, this isn't the settlement of a new world. This, from the point of view of the people on the shore, is an invasion. The second one that came out around 2000, 2001, is by a historian at Penn named Dan Richter, who wrote a book called Facing East from Indian Country. And he gets us again to look out from Indian Country to the arrival of Europeans. So it's this shift in perspective. And what I was arguing We also need to have a shift in vocabulary to get back to the William & Mary Quarterly article that you introduced to me.
Yeah, the shift of perspective in terms of conventional history writing. You have these wonderful quotes at the beginning of the article. One was by Washington, and then there's another by a Seneca leader. His name was Corn Planter.
Yes.
That second one really struck me. I know that there was a great many lies written in your books concerning us.
Yes.
And it's kind of prescient understanding of written history.
Right.
And Washington's was very much like that, that these people have no press, etc. And that's a tremendous disadvantage. So history plays into this kind of amnesia of all things, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. Even when people at the time are aware of it. Washington is writing this in 1795. Poor wretches, they have no press through which their grievances are relayed.
Yes, yeah.
And it's well known that when one side only of a story is heard and often repeated, the human mind becomes impressed with it. And what's the last word? Insensibly. In other words, Washington knew that the native story was not getting told in his own time. Washington himself was friend and ally, as well as foe, of many Native Americans when he was in his 20s. Mm-hmm. He was marching off to war against the French with Catawba and Cherokee men, and for decades after that, he had many natives. The Catawba people, a number of them, we don't know exactly who, in 1796, Washington is taking a break from being president, and he's vacationing at Mount Vernon, and he notes in his diary that some Catawbas had come to visit him unannounced, and they're continuing to forge this bond with their old comrade at arms. And so, even as he recognized the Native American story wasn't getting fully told, he himself was a part of showing the way Native Americans were contributing to the larger story, whether it was fighting the French or later on when Washington arrived to take command of the army outside of Boston in 1775. Native Americans were among the troops that he met when Congress appointed him the commander of the army, and he goes up there and there were Native Americans from New England who were already in the Continental Army.
Wasn't one of his early orders of business to convene a Native convention? Am I right about that?
You're thinking when he was
president. Yeah.
Well, the first treaty that the United States signed that was ratified by the Senate was with the Creek Indians. And it was held in New York City, which was then the capital, and the Creeks came up from their southern homelands in large numbers, and Abigail Adams wrote about them, and they had their pictures painted. And yes, Washington was dealing with them as he was dealing with French or other emissaries.
Yeah, interesting. So because we're dealing with the founding of the nation with this material, does this make it a sort of intractable problem in that you're dealing with mythology to some extent? I mean, here we're talking about George Washington. So we're talking about the founding of the country to some extent. So does that make it difficult? I mean, you have one account. It's the account where Washington records in his diary an encounter with a group of Indians, and then his biographer gives the same account, and it's entirely different from Washington's account, basically. He just meets a group of fairly friendly Indians and spends the night with them. But according to Ellis, you know, they've got scalps. It's a war party, basically.
Right.
So, which Washington doesn't mention at all. So
that was actually in the piece about abuse of vocabulary in the William & Mary Quarterly article.
Yeah,
And what I was trying to argue in that part of it was there's a tendency to think of Indians only as warriors, as people who resisted the advance of European colonists, and to look at every encounter through a sort of racially and blood-tinged lens that assumes the worst. And Washington saw a lot of terrible things did a lot of terrible things and avoided getting killed at various times by Native Americans. But in this case, it was a much more complicated and nuanced and amiable meeting with different Native Americans that I thought that Professor Ellis had given a gloss that was much more dark and much more bloody than perhaps it needed to be.
Making him look more like a brave soldier in a way than a young kid.
Exactly.
So with vocabulary, can you talk about that again? Because we do use charged terms. Historians do use charged terms all the time. To terms that seem like common terms. Terms like wilderness, you wouldn't think it would be but that have a whole kind of mythology that they drag along with them.
It's fascinating to me, and I want to say when I talk about we are using terms that are distorted or are loaded terms, I include myself in that. Going back through my own work, I realize that I too am part of this larger conversation, and it's so deeply embedded that it doesn't really get noticed. We've made a lot of progress. We no longer call Native people savages. Mm-hmm. We no longer call their religion primitive or superstition. We have greater respect for their diplomatic skills.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, you move past it. The only term that really still is out there in public discourse and is acceptable that should be, in my view, is Redskins. That this is a term that is as pejorative as various negative terms for different ethnic and racial religious groups, and yet it is still part of the conversation. Yeah. What I'm saying now is that at another level, there are terms that seem innocuous in themselves, but that are profoundly for example, talking about the old world and the new world. All of a sudden, you're privileging one and making the other out to be somehow new. It was only new to the Europeans who arrived here. It was not new to the natives who had greeted them. Another term that we hear a lot is pre-contact.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you about Native Americans pre-contact.
Yeah.
Well, Native Americans had been having contact with strangers who spoke strange tongues and looked differently and dressed differently for millennia before the Europeans arrived, that makes the Europeans out to be the only contact worth considering. We would never say that the Europeans coming to America were a pre-contact people, because we know they were in touch not only with other Europeans, but with Africa and Middle East and so on.
Yeah.
So even a term like pre-contact, or, as you noticed, wilderness. Wilderness is in the eye of the beholder. It's where one feels bewildered. Yeah. Uh-huh. And Native Americans, they thought of wilderness was more likely Philadelphia or New York City than it was their own homeland.
Well, you have nice passages, though, on the way the woods bewildered them also. And that, you know, their understanding of the forest had a lot in common with it, with the Europeans' understanding.
That the Europeans kept talking about the woods in the inhabited parts. That's how colonial record keepers talked about going from, say, Philadelphia or Albany or Poughkeepsie into Indian country.
Yeah.
The inhabited parts was where colonists were in control. So they would say, I went to this large Indian town in the woods, even though you know, they recognize that there are large towns and fields and houses and so on.
Yeah.
But Native Americans too, and you're right, this is one of the ways in which natives and colonists found common ground. They could all agree that there was a wilderness, and it was some of the same parts of the early American landscape that they found intimidating and bewildering, and where it was dangerous for them to venture.
So are there other terms that come to mind? You do call it, your second book, Into the American Woods.
Yes, and that was a deliberate play because, as you noted, Native Americans have this concept of woods, which is a dangerous place where you need to be careful in when you go.
Yes,
and so I was suggesting that it's just not the same woods that the colonists argued the woods, which included any place that Native Americans were in control.
Yeah.
Other terms that you should think about, that we should think about, and that I've tried to think about, is the term settler. We use settler in all kinds of different ways. Settler colonialism is a very popular term now, and a very useful term. But from the Native point of view, the people who came over were not settlers. Mm-hmm. They were unsettled. They came into a landscape that was, from the Native point of view, tamed, settled, able to provide the resources they needed to live, and tore up that landscape in one way or another and changed it. So I've heard it said, and I've said myself, that Europeans didn't find a wilderness when they came to America. They made a wilderness from the Native point of view. And I have no objection to settler as long as it has an adjective.
Yeah.
So a European settler, or a Tuscarora settler, or a Catawba settler, that's fine. Having said that, I have a whole chapter in my first book on the Catawbas called The Settlers' Invasion. So it is clearly a term that I have been wrestling with and I have used, because it's, again, it's so common and it seems so innocuous until you step back and think about it.
Yeah, interesting.
Another one I might just toss in is removal.
Uh-huh.
Indian removal is a major chapter in American history, and I think pretty much everybody can agree that this was a tragic chapter in American history. But even at the time, the opponents of removal wondered about the term itself. It seems a rather antiseptic term.
It does, for
the displacement of a large population based on their ethnic or racial difference.
Yeah.
Another term that has come into the international conversation in the last 20 or 30 years, and it probably has been around longer, I only noticed it in the last 20 or 30 years, is ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
Well, it takes on a whole different cast if you call what happened to the Cherokees and the Creeks ethnic cleansing instead of removal. It suddenly has a darker and bloodier and more pernicious aspect.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Japanese internment camps being called reallocation camps rather than concentration camps.
Exactly.
But, you know,
exactly. And my wife Linda, who is Japanese American, and her parents, grandparents were interned, she too talks about the way in which they call it relocation centers instead of incarceration.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the way in which we use terminology is not restricted to the Native experience. It goes beyond that.
Yeah. So your article in the William & Mary Quarterly, did it stir up a controversy? It's a follow-on of earlier work that you've done, right?
Yes.
Because people looked to your earlier work, especially your work on the Catawbas, as a new kind of history writing about that had to do with Native Americans.
Yes.
And somewhere along the line, I'm thinking possibly you had an article where you talked about the fact that there were very few people actually writing about Native Americans in colonial history.
Yeah.
And then there was a flood, of course, of people doing exactly that.
Right.
So
It has changed dramatically. And the article that we've been talking about that came out in 2012 is called Second Thoughts Colonial Historians and American Indians. And it is a follow-up to one I wrote in the 1980s called Some Thoughts on Colonial Historians and American Indians. And that one was arguing that there is new work on Indians and we need to pay more attention to it.
Yeah.
It's true that there isn't as much as there will be.
Yeah.
And it was sort of at the beginning of this renaissance in the study of Native peoples in early America.
Yeah. And colonial history, too.
And
sense,
colonial history.
Yeah.
And colonial history is another term
that
I've had to start thinking about more, too, because from the Native American point of view, the colonial period doesn't end in 1776 or in 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. The colonial period endures to the present day. So if you go down this path too far, it can get very interesting and very complicated.
Yeah.
One of the other points I've made also is early America. Why do we call the period from, say, 1500 to 1800 early America? We don't call it early Europe because it's early from a European means of telling time.
Yeah.
You can go too far with this.
Yeah.
You can say, well, we shouldn't, we're not going to be able to say anything.
Yeah.
My own view is, and I know that there is a response to this. You talked about, did it stir up a controversy?
An Indian behind every bush was the term that I
An Indian behind every bush, yes. And I want people to be thinking and being on the lookout for them more.
Yeah.
I would say that it wasn't as controversial as I had hoped, that it didn't stir up as much pushback. I think that people either read it and accepted my point or read it and dismissed it out of hand and called it, the term that's so often bandied about these days is political correctness. You know, you're just, if you take settler away and you take old world, new world, it's all just political correctness. And my response to that has always been, it's not political correctness, it's just correctness. To call America an old world in 1492 as well as Europe being an old world. And it's not correct to call people settlers when they're coming in to invade somebody else's territory. And so it's an effort to set the record straight in ways. But I've been surprised. And I even wrote the article with a tone that was intended to be somewhat light, but also somewhat contentious and tendentious. And I haven't gotten too many takers in terms of people writing me and saying you're way off base or writing articles that were countering it. And it was part of a forum in which five other scholars wrote right on the spot. And that was a very useful and interesting exchange.
Yeah, there were interesting responses. One I remember particularly, I can't remember who it was, but it talked about the fact that it felt it wasn't vocabulary so much, but it was the mythology behind that vocabulary that that history perpetuates.
Yes.
And that there is a kind of narrative that we draw on, an earlier narrative, to some extent biblical, that has to do with notions of space and time, progress particularly, but also spatial.
And with the role of wilderness
exactly.
in the human story. I think that's true. I think my response to that was, yes, we are embedded in a mythology that is deep and almost bedrock level in the way we look at the world.
Yeah.
But I'm proposing a fairly simple way of combating that mythology, not by demolishing it and rebuilding something right on the spot, but by saying, let's think about the words we use to talk about that mythology.
Yeah, sure.
And every time we talk about settlers and wilderness and old world and new world, we are perpetuating that, and this is a kind of a quick fix, a temporary patch, until we can really take a good look at ourselves and realize the kinds of stories that we're comfortable telling and the ones we're not comfortable telling.
Yeah. So would it do to imagine a notable Indian in the room, like when you're building these narratives, you know, Seneca George sitting in a corner listening to what you have to say and thinking, this isn't going to sit right with George.
I don't consciously
do that.
I don't consciously do that because I don't pretend to know what someone like Seneca George or some other 18th century Native go-between would be thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
But one of the great things that is happening in the field now is, first of all, there are more Native people who are combining their own heritage and history with academic training and are entering the profession and writing quite wonderful books. The other big advance has been where they themselves are of Native descent and are members of Native nations today, other people are making connections with modern-day Native American communities and informing their work through the perspective of those natives. So I would say natives are not only in the room, they're doing the talking, they're doing the writing, and yes, they are being consulted far more than they were in past time. Yeah.
So with vocabularies, part of the problem that language can prevent us from understanding, in a sense, and that it exacerbates a sort of sense of otherness, you know, in our conception here of what Indian culture and life are, in a way. It makes it more other than it need be.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so we have this understanding that natives are warriors, they're hunters, they're not planters. I was under the impression before I got to know a little more about Native American history than I used to, that Native Americans had no concept of property, of real estate, but that's not true at all. They're just as concerned about real estate as anybody. You
that's know, right. They have a different relationship with that real estate.
Yeah. And they don't have surveyors, but
exactly, and they may have different conceptions of ownership, and what ownership even means.
Yeah.
But the notion that they didn't have boundary lines or they didn't have any sense of where their territory ends, they had all of that. But of course, it was convenient for Europeans to say, "Oh, they don't understand anything about this."
Yeah. So is there a point then, historically, to the sort of misconceptualization of other cultures? Do they serve a purpose? I mean, confiscation of land, for one. I mean, that's what we're talking about now, but they do seem to serve a kind of purpose, don't they?
They do. If you think of these people as savage, as inferior, as just hunters who roam across the land, that you can downplay, if not dismiss, their attachment to the land, their possession of the land, and the land's possession of them, and can see yourself acting in the name either of a higher power, and again back to biblical stories, or in the name of progress and civilization, that we're going to not only come over and take this land and use it properly by our lights, we're going to, some colonists said, we're going to help the natives to realize the error of their ways and teach them our ways. And what all this overlooks is that scholars who have been working on this have discovered that Native American agriculture was far more productive than European agriculture at that time. You could reap more food from less labor and more reliably using Native American customary techniques than you could European customary techniques in the 14th and 15th century. The other part of that made it invisible to Europeans was that women in the East were doing most of the farming. And if women were doing the work, it by definition couldn't be that important. And so even as they were learning how to survive in this land from native people and getting supplies, John Smith was constantly trading or stealing corn from the natives and trying to trade for corn. Same thing with the Pilgrims and Squanto teaching them how. They tended to overlook agriculture with the natives because it didn't fit their conceptual paradigm of who does the important work here.
Also, you make it plain that there's a very sophisticated sense of law, in a sense, that the Native peoples have. Different Native peoples, complex systems that they don't all share necessarily the same rules, but they do have them. And also ways of negotiating these kinds of things.
These are widespread across the eastern part of the continent, and they obviously, as you say, they have variations.
But so do the French and the English. Everybody has variations, don't they? So
exactly. And what you see in the early years of the colonial encounters with Native peoples is that Europeans have to learn the Native protocols for diplomacy. Yeah. So you'll see very highly trained and educated Englishmen standing there with a belt of wampum beads in their hand and speaking the Native protocols about how you start a conversation in a diplomatic forum with Native peoples. Even as their scribes are writing things down, they have to follow Native American rules.
Yeah, what strikes me as a medievalist about a lot of what you wrote about is the importance of oratory and rhetoric in these cultures, because it seems very important, and there are people who are really good at it who have become very useful.
Which is another area of common ground between the natives and the colonists, oratory is something that the colonists value, and it's a performance, and they may not understand everything a Native person is saying, but they see a great great performance, yeah. and they know it. Nancy yeah. Shoemaker and other scholars have focused in on this and yeah. said, you know, obviously there are a lot of difference between Europeans and natives operating in the Eastern theater, but when it comes to things like oratory, they admire it. They yeah. both admire it, and they find similar cues in what's admirable about that oratory. Yeah. Drama, pauses, uh-huh. pacing yes. back and yeah. forth, yeah. these kinds of things appeal to both sides.
Yeah, interesting. It's very interesting. You know, and I asked if lack of understanding essentially served a political purpose at the time, but do they still serve a political purpose is a question I'm thinking of. The Dakota Access Pipeline struggle, you know, where fake news actually is being promulgated by present-day confiscators of native land, you know, continues this old legacy of theft and violence. So is that the case? Is history then correlative to this or corrective in some way, especially to the extent that history can inform law and the practice of law? And I should note that it was in the news yesterday that the Sioux tribe won a really important court case in the Dakota Access Pipeline, a struggle there, yeah. and that it was made plain that the law wasn't followed with respect to environmental damage being done by the pipelines.
I haven't seen that article yet. That's quite wonderful.
Yeah, the law still can serve a purpose, but history informs the law to some extent. So
I would say that I know a lot more and have thought a lot more cogently about these issues for the 17th and 18th and
yes.
the 19th century than I have for the 21st.
Century, yeah.
Now, having said that, I can say that it does seem to me that this is a continuation of the sort of structures and assumptions
yeah.
that colonialism put into place
yes,
here
yes,
centuries
yeah.
ago, and the same sorts of attitudes towards Native peoples and their rights.
Yeah.
One of the differences that you've already identified, and that is that Natives have learned
uh-huh.
from years of struggle and pain and loss,
yeah.
they've learned how to use the European invaders' tools,
yeah.
like the law,
yeah.
to fight back.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That they're no longer now launching war
yeah.
and sending war parties
yeah.
off. Their war parties are now lawyers.
Yeah.
Many of them themselves Native Americans. And so there is a contest there. And you see that even as early as the colonial period.
You know, diplomacy is hugely important in your book, isn't it? It's all about diplomacy, more so than it is war. I mean,
exactly.
the French and Indian War is a kind of aberration almost from the kind of business as usual that the Native peoples are used to conducting with one another.
And as is often the case, people nowadays and throughout history tend to focus more on wars
yeah, they do, yeah.
than they do
they
on
do,
peaceful
yeah.
negotiation.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's not as dramatic. It's less likely to make a fine movie or anything like
yeah.
that. And so we tend to overlook the fact that wars broke out from established structures of peaceful relations that these
yeah.
different peoples had put together, over generations.
Yeah. yeah, and that they were trying to maintain with Europeans that they met
right.
so,
exactly.
in their own ways. So.
Exactly.
So when you talk then about the Catawbas and their neighbors, you weren't entirely able to avoid the kind of vocabulary problems.
Not at all.
But even so, you do make a place for them in your book and in your history. Well, I'm looking at the title of your book, The Indian's New World. That implies a sort of paradigm shift in a way in terms of the Indian's own experience as well as the colonizers. But in your title there, The Indian's New World, is this the historian's new world too? I guess that's the question I really have.
Yeah.
And that should be introduced to this new world as well as Europeans in a way.
Well, I don't think I was explicitly thinking about that, Tom, but I think
yeah,
that
yeah,
you're right,
yeah.
that what I wanted to do with the notion of an Indian's new world
yeah.
is, new world is something that we all grew up thinking about, that
uh-huh.
this is the new
yeah.
world, and
yeah.
of course Native Americans didn't participate in that because they were already here.
Yeah.
And my argument was, if we don't think of the new world as a place, but as a historical experience,
uh-huh.
then what happens in the Catawba's case
yeah.
in the North American Southeast after 1500
uh-huh.
is very much a new world. They have to deal with rapid change and almost
yeah.
a foreign environment with
uh-huh.
the arrival
yeah.
of Europeans and their diseases and trade
yeah.
and
yeah,
so
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
So I wanted people to say, you know what, if you want to talk about New World, fine, but that should include Native people
uh-huh.
as well as Europeans and Africans
yeah,
and others.
And they undergo a tremendous amount of change themselves, don't
right.
they? Because that's what your book is about, the book on the Catawbas, isn't
yes.
it? How much adjusting they actually had to do and how successful they were.
And
at,
how successful and they were
yeah.
within the confines of
oh,
a
yeah.
very
yeah.
difficult
yeah.
And continuing difficult situation in which they found themselves. But I was hoping that people would see it as part of a new trend in understanding Native American history. And as I say, Francis Jennings and James Axtell and other scholars were already hard at work on this.
Yeah.
I was hardly the first person to suggest we need a new direction. But I wanted the new world as a metaphor to be something that could be more broadly applied than it was.
So why did you focus on the Catawbas? Was it because you were at Hopkins and Maryland in the same spot that they...
It was happenstance, to tell you the truth. I did not go to graduate school thinking that I would study Native Americans.
Oh.
I went to graduate school. Johns Hopkins had a very fine department, and I was there to work with Jack Green, who was a distinguished scholar of especially the Revolution, but also intellectual constitutional American history. And when I got there, I learned that I had to write a major paper in my first year on any topic I wanted in early American history, and I realized I didn't know much about early American history. I had one class in college, and it was a very seminal class for me, taught by a guy named Doug Greenberg, and that led me to want to do early America. So in desperation, I went back to my notes from my college course, and I started flipping through and looking through, and there was discussion of Indians, there were discussion of Puritans, and there were discussions of various things, and that prompted, for some reason in my head, I don't think it was actually in my notes, Professor Greenberg saying, we don't know as much about Indians in early America as we should. So I said, I'll start from there.
Yeah, okay.
And that led me to work on a group in Maryland, the Piscataways, who are still there.
Yeah.
They're recognized as the sort of the homeland where the National Museum of the American Indian is now, has an exhibit on the Piscataways because they were right along the Potomac there where D.C. is. So I wrote that paper, and it was all about cultural continuity among the Piscataways.
Oh.
And I knew that I wanted to look for a group that had endured.
Yeah.
And I knew a lot of people were working on the Iroquois, the Haudenosaunee in New York, and the Delaware were fairly popular.
Yeah.
I was quite consciously looking for a group that was still around but that hadn't gotten as much attention.
Yeah.
And that led me a few hundred miles south to the southern Piedmont of the Carolinas, where the Catawbas were when the first Spanish explorers came through and where they are still today.
Are they a cohesive group?
Scholars...
They're not a confederation quite. But
they're not a confederation. They talk about the creation of the Catawba Nation in the 18th century. So they did become... Part of their neighbors was other groups in the Piedmont that, in the face of war and disease and dispossession, were too small to survive on their own. They came to the Catawba Nation and coalesced during the 18th century so that they became what we think of as the Catawba Nation today, but there are many different strands within that fabric.
So part of the problem here is that we have two cultures, Europeans and the natives, in close contact with one another and to some extent interdependent on one another, especially once trade begins and that Indian peoples become incredibly dependent on that trade. But they don't really have common terms of understanding quite. I mean, you know, they can eke out agreements that, you know, they can both live with often. So is a problem here often between natives and settlers or Europeans or whatever you want to say, a problem of understanding, I suppose, is, I don't know if that's much of a question, but I'm kind of leading into your other book is what I'm doing.
Right.
So
I do think that there is a limit of understanding. I don't think that there's as much of a limit as we often think. For example, I think that the Catawbas came to understand the colonists quite well. And that they had to in order to survive among them to know exactly what behaviors were going to get them in trouble and what behaviors would be acceptable. And
they weren't always, the colonists weren't always getting along with one another, were they?
No.
Especially various colonies.
No,
they were
they
having
were
their
not.
Own trade wars.
No, they were not.
So, yeah, so.
And they also knew the Catawbas ended up fighting on the side of the American Rebellion in 1776. It's not that they were somehow prescient and they knew who was going to win, but many of the people around them were on the side of the rebels, and they thought it would be politic for us to also be on the side of the rebels. And so what's crucial there is thereafter they always made a point of emphasizing, whenever they were with colonists, emphasizing their service in the successful rebellion. They would wear their old uniforms, they would visit, as they visited George Washington and Mount Vernon, they would visit old commanders, they would talk with other veterans, we know about this, and so they even said, up until 1776, we had kings, but after 1776, we no longer have kings, our leader is now a general. And so this is what I mean by their understanding of it became very profound and very subtle.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, what I think is true is that they kept the heart of their own nation and their own secrets from these prying eyes of outsiders, that they were not as forthcoming about. Occasionally people would travel through the nation and say, I'm really interested in Indians, tell me all, and they would find ways to deflect those questions and those conversations about their kinship patterns or their beliefs, and these people would leave feeling, bless them, they wrote a lot of interesting things that I learned a lot from, but you always had a feeling that the Catawbas were trying to keep them at arm's length, not to reveal as much of themselves.
Yeah, it's kind of a bane of Indian studies in history, too, isn't it?
Yes,
it's
hard
to get information out of people.
And well, rightfully reason, so. And it's true for scholars today that people don't want to necessarily be subjects of somebody else's scholarly inquiry, and you can't blame them a bit.
So, Into the American Woods, it's about negotiators and middlemen and translators that exist in this world between the native and the colonists. These are people who aren't always remembered. Their names aren't remembered, but they're incredibly important. Obviously, they would be. I mean, you just have to think about it. You have to have people translating language, but culture also, and protocols. So, so there were people like this, weren't there?
Yes.
And
we know about their famous Squanto could be considered a cultural go-between like this. Pocahontas was another who served as an intermediary in different ways.
So there were women that did this as well as men.
The women don't get as much attention, but they were often central in the larger conversation, even when Europeans didn't necessarily always notice them because Europeans expected these figures to be men.
Yeah.
I got interested in them because there were a couple of these figures for the Catawbas.
Mm-hmm.
There was a man named Matthew Toole, for example, who did a lot of interpreting for them and wrote a lot of their letters to the governor in Charleston. And I felt like I wasn't really getting enough. I was always trying to look past him to see the Catawbas. And I realized, you know what? People like him deserve a little bit more attention. And that's when I ended up working in Pennsylvania. I felt like there was a lot of material in Pennsylvania. And frankly, by the time that it was time to think about the next book, I was at Vassar. Vassar has an incredible collection of sources on colonial Pennsylvania. In the 19th century, Pennsylvania published what they call the Pennsylvania Archives, which is 149 volumes in about 8 different series of their colonial records. They were all sitting on Vassar's shelves. I was starting out in my teaching career. I had a lot of things going on. I had young children. And I knew I could do a heavy amount of the research for this. I did end up going to a lot of archives in Pennsylvania. But I could do a lot of the research. So how did I come to choose that particular Pennsylvania frontier rather than the Carolina frontier or some other? Partly it was strategic. And I was interested because it was also so many different groups were there.
Yeah.
So many different Native groups as well as so many different European groups that seemed like a good place to plant myself and have a look around.
Also hugely important to colonial history and then post-colonial history also.
Yes.
The revolution is in Pennsylvania.
Absolutely.
From Penn on.
Absolutely. And also Pennsylvania is famous and rightfully so for Penn's vision of people getting along and the peaceful kingdom. And I wanted to look at the way in which that unfolded. How much of that was myth? How much of that was reality? And what I found was that Native Americans played a large role in sustaining the story of William Penn because they would keep his memory alive long after he had left the colony. He left the colony for the last time in 1701, I think. And 1740s, 50s, 60s, Native people were still coming to Philadelphia and saying, we remember when William Penn was here and he met our grandfathers and was friendly with them, and we expect the same from you. So the mythology of Penn's peaceable kingdom was carried in part by Native minds and tongues.
Yeah, interesting. Unfortunately, Pennsylvania had fewer Native Americans in it when things settle out than, you know, the
that
rest
is
of the
great
East
irony.
Coast.
Yeah, that is the great irony, that there are fewer Native American peoples recognized by state or federal level in Pennsylvania than in many of its other neighbor states.
So what qualities made for a good negotiator? I mean, were these people who were able to translate and able to keep the peace, essentially? It just comes to mind, what makes a good negotiator? Is it a good rhetorician? Is it somebody that doesn't offend people? Is it somebody, a good politician, ambassador? I mean, we have these, even in European history, sort of famous people that serve as ambassadors sometimes and go-betweens. These people tended to get lost, didn't they? In colonial history, you don't know their names, even though everybody knew their names at the time.
That's right.
You knew who to be. They were go-to people.
One of the more famous ones that I was studying was a man named Andrew Montour, whose mother, Madame Montour, as she was known, was a very prominent go-between in her own right. And then when she got too old, Andrew Montour became central, and George Washington wrote a letter that I quote, it was 1754, 1755, he was out on the frontier and he wrote to somebody in Pennsylvania, send me Andrew Montour, more or less, so that I could figure out what is going on around here. What did these people need? They certainly, they needed to be a pretty hardy bunch, because one of the things that I did in the book was to look at the difficulties of travel. So many times I was, my own thinking was, well, the Indians show up and then the action starts. And I came to realize that a lot of what these individuals were doing was getting from one place to another, and what the meaning of their travels was. They also had to have a tremendous amount of patience, because they were dealing with all kinds of peoples, many of whom were quite arrogant. And I'm saying this with great respect for natives as well as colonists. But a lot of these colonists...
These are important people in their own communities, aren't they?
The imperial officials in these colonies were of the highest class. They tended to look down on colonists, much less on native peoples. And so part of it was keeping those figures to... and getting them to adapt to and keep their mouths shut and not make faces when natives were not assembling as fast as they could. And on the other side, the native leaders too were men of considerable confidence and arrogance, and you had to deal with them in a way that showed respect for them, but also tried to get them to do things on a timetable that they might not have wanted to, or to say things that they may not have been comfortable saying. So a lot of this is a sense of managerial skills, and I guess we would call them people skills, quite apart from the linguistic and cultural protocols that they had.
Plus, they'd have to know how to get from A to B in a canoe, right?
So,
I mean, that was part part of it,
And that's another thing that I found that was fascinating, was that if you look at the records, that this is part of the mythology, right? The Native Americans were master woodsmen, and they could find their way hundreds of miles without knowing where you could drop them anywhere, and they'd find their way home. I find plenty of records of Native Americans getting lost on the trail, falling out of canoes, and various other mishaps that suggest that they were far more human than superhuman. Not that they didn't know the travels through the woods well, but this notion that they were some kind of superhuman figure in the woods that colonists couldn't match was an exaggeration, not a myth.
Seneca George himself drowned, didn't he?
Seneca George himself drowned. Whether he fell out
or jumped
is a question I leave the reader with. I don't know the answer to that, obviously, but it's apparently, from the way I read the records, the Iroquois felt that he had jumped.
Oh, did they? That's too bad. So. But emblematic, I suppose. So if history doesn't treat these people well, does literature? I mean, I think of Cooper's Natty Bumppo, Hawkeye, as being one of these people, like your Irish fellow who was...
George Crumb.
So does literature at least take an interest in them?
And, I think it
does. Does it sometimes do history a better service than history does? That's the question. I mean, I don't know what your view of Cooper is. I mean, he was... writing much after the fact, but he's got a memory of that. That's something
he's writing much after the fact, but he's reading materials that had been written by people who knew natives very well.
Yeah, so he's going to the source with
history. He's going to the source in that sense. He's up in Iroquois country, but he's not actually going to Iroquois sources very much, but he's reading missionary sources.
Yeah, he despises the Mingos, as he calls them.
Yes, and he makes some Indians into noble savages and others into incredible savages.
He does,
But he had a sense of the dramatic possibilities of these people who are between the way Natty Bumppo was. And I do think that there is more room in literature or in film for these people. I suppose you could look at, I don't know, Dances with Wolves and Kevin Costner's role there. He's not quite a go-between, but he's someone who is between. He's sort of rejected the white world, and he's trying to ingratiate himself with the native world in various ways. So I do think that they have gotten more attention from the novelists and filmmakers than they have from historians.
Yeah. So is this, and I don't know if you were thinking of this while you were writing that second book, but is this a figure for the historian too? Who is a kind of translator? You know, what's the saying? The past is a foreign country.
Yeah, the past is a foreign country. Yeah. They do things differently there.
Yeah.
That was L.P. Harvey.
So, I mean, it's the perfect figure, these negotiators, for the historian and for a translator too of any kind. So,
I think I did see myself something in that role.
Yeah.
At one point, I think at the end of the introduction, I say something like, they can help us not only translate between native cultures and colonial cultures, but between their world and our own. And I think I saw my role as something like that. But of course, they're not around to be able to speak for themselves now, nor do I have to translate any questions that might come from our world back to theirs. So in that sense, I'm not doing my job if I'm really a go-between.
You mentioned the Pennsylvania Archives and the Vassar Collection. Can you talk about the libraries that you worked in? And I'm thinking of that first book when you were in Baltimore, working on your dissertation, but elsewhere also. I mean, do a lot of travel? Are things tend to be local? Yeah. Are there special collections that are really rich in Indian sources?
I did find, for the first book, the research I did took me to many different archives. Library of Congress had material, besides, obviously, the Johns Hopkins Library, which was very good. I spent time in North Carolina talking to archaeologists at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who were doing a lot of work on Piedmont native sites. I spent time in Rock Hill, South Carolina, which is near the present Catawba Nation, and they have a large collection in the York County Library. I spent many weeks in Columbia, South Carolina, doing research at the South Carolina Department of Archives and History, where a lot of the colonial records had survived. So, yes, that was pretty far-flung, going from one archive to another and poking around. The same thing was to some extent true of the Into the American Woods book, although I was much more grounded here. I didn't have as many, I don't think I had any month-long research trips, partly because Pennsylvania was closer so I could come home on the weekends. But I did have a couple of summers where I was in Philadelphia more than I was in Poughkeepsie, I think.
So most of these sources would be colonial sources. Are any of them Indian sources? You had a wonderful image in one of your books of Indian signatures on a treaty, which were very accomplished. They looked they looked like they could certainly write and they could certainly sign their names.
That was in the Catawba book, and some of those Catawbas did have some background and training by that point. Another way in which they were learning about the foreign world that had surrounded them and learning how to manipulate it by, we have to teach our own people to read so that we can read the treaties too. Those I would count as native sources. I also used a lot of field work that anthropologists and ethnographers had done in the late 19th and early 20th century, as well as linguistic sources. Not ever being able to master any of these languages myself, I relied heavily on the work of people who had specialized in the Catawba language and in the languages of the Iroquois and the Lenape and others. Yeah. So, as well as folklore collected in the 19th and 20th century by people who would have been born around 1800 or even a little bit before telling their stories. So there's a great deal of material. I did not, and this is an area where the field in our own times has advanced and improved on what I did, I think, and done so dramatically. I did not spend a lot of time with Native peoples today talking with them about my own research and what they might know about the areas of our common interest. And this is something that I do think has added a whole new dimension to the scholarly endeavors in Native American history.
People have stories that have been passed down, that kind of thing.
When I did talk with Catawbas, one of whom was born in the 1910s, and we talked a little bit about time depth and how far back would you say that your own family memories go? And he said, I can tell you things about the Civil War period that I heard. If you go back 100 years before that, but that's, that was one person and one family. The other thing that's interesting that scholars have done, and Lisa Brooks, who teaches, I think, at Amherst, has brought this out, that she works on New England Native peoples, and she said, if you're doing the 17th century, maybe they don't have family traditions that go back 300, 400 years, but what they do have is a perspective on the very same documents and the very same accounts from those times, that a perspective on that from their own background and their own traditions that can be invaluable and can give you a different take.
Kind of oral memory, that's
right.
Great.
So it does change the character of the conversation and the research.
Interesting. So can you tell me what you're working on next?
Yes. I've moved closer to home.
Have you?
I'm working on the Mid-Hudson Valley.
Oh, I was going to... Wappingers then?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Exactly.
A lot of work on the Wappingers, has there?
So, no, there has not. I got interested in this, and it goes back to my original training, which was to see Native peoples as part of the early American story.
Yes.
And in 1766, Poughkeepsie and Dutchess County were very well known. However little known they were before and however little known they have been since, in 1766 they got a lot of attention because in that year there were land riots. The local tenant farmers rose up in an armed rebellion against the landlords. The Beekmans and Livingstons and Phillipses.
Were these indentured servants or were they?
No, these were tenant farmers.
Tenant farmers,
tenant farmers who felt that they were being squeezed by these landlords into very high rents and very short leases and were getting evicted when they refused to pay. They rose up in rebellion. They marched on New York City and demanded a meeting with the government and threatened to burn down the town if the governor did not meet with them. He called out the army, he called out the local militia, and they turned around and came back. Their headquarters was out near Pawling on the eastern part of the county now, near the Connecticut line. But they marched all the way to Poughkeepsie and sprang one of their own men out of jail because he'd been thrown into jail for debt.
Several hundred men.
And then the landlords and the officials call in the British regulars. So in the summer of 1766, 10 years before the revolution, British soldiers landed on the Poughkeepsie docks and marched east looking for these tenant rioters who picked up their guns and fought them in a firefight that the British took casualties. They broke them up. And there was a major, there was a series of trials, but there was a show trial in the Dutchess County Courthouse here in August of 1766 of the tenant rioters' leader, a man named William Prendergast. So that's one way that Poughkeepsie was famous. This is getting covered not only in the New York City newspapers, but in Boston, in Williamsburg, in Philadelphia.
Yeah, it's kind of a lost history now.
It is a lost history. The same year, at the same time that that trial for Prendergast was going on in the Dutchess County Courthouse, the Wappingers leader, a man named Daniel Nimmo, is in London with three other native leaders from the Stockbridge Mohican people right up in Massachusetts. And he was there to meet with the leaders of English society. Some people say he met with the King George III himself. I'm not sure if that happened yet. I'm still trying to track it down. People have told this as two different stories. One is, well, this is how the Wappingers lost their land, and it forms a small chapter in the larger saga of how the Wappingers lost their land. The other is those who are interested in crowd action and mobs in free revolutionary America, they look at William Prendergast and the rioters. What I've come to see is that this is one story. First of all, it's the same land that they're arguing over. The land that the Wappingers said they wanted back was taken from them by the very landlords that are squeezing the tenant rioters.
Beekmans, so are these patent holders, English patent holders, after the Dutch pull out there?
These are men like Henry Beekman and the Livingston family and the Phillips family who are the big patent holders along the east side of the Hudson River. Not only is it the same land, not only do they have the same enemies in the landlords, but before the fighting breaks out and before Daniel Nimmo gets on board ship to go to England, he's starting to rent the land to the tenants. So these tenant farmers have Wappinger landlords as a way to reinforce each other's claims to this land. And of course, the Wappingers as landlords are a lot easier on these individuals in terms of the demand for what the rent will be and how long the term will be. And so they are conspiring together with one another and crossing the bridge. We think of it, well, they're colonists and they're Indians and they don't get together. In this corner of colonial America, they did. And so I'm digging deep into these records and see what the pattern of understanding and mutual respect and agreement was beneath the surface of what happens in the famous battles of 1766 and 1765.
So you have Wappingers then engaged in overseas negotiation with the English crown. Where the colonists, I don't know if they're negotiating also or they're just shooting.
The colonists are just shooting. To put it in proverbial terms, the colonists go on the warpath. And the Wappingers, they hire lawyers.
It sounds like a great book.
They literally hire lawyers. They tried to get lawyers in New York City, but no New York City lawyer would touch them because he's going to lose all of his other business if he goes against the big landlord. They hire a couple of Yale guys, a couple of Connecticut lawyers to take their case.
That's great.
Fantastic. So I talked earlier about how today natives are using the law to defend their sovereignty and their rights. Well, Daniel Nimmo, the Wappingers leader, was doing this in the 1760s.
Sounds fascinating, so you've got to get this book written.
Well, I'm working on it.
Okay. So I'd like to thank you, Jim, for talking with us today about your work on Native America before the American Revolution.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been great.